Hello, humans. Welcome to episode 33 of All You Ever Think About Is Sparks, the only, and therefore best podcast devoted to the music of Ron and Russell Nail. I am Computer Girl, from the song Computer Girl. You are hereby ordered to enjoy the next hour and a half, wherein Christian, Monty, Paul, Penny, and Joe discuss the first half of the 2023 Sparks album, The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte. Upon having finished assimilating the information held therein, you must then listen to Monty's podcast So Important, watch Paul's YouTube channel MetaSparks, read Penny Brown's blog Sparks Talk at sparkstalkbypenny.blogspot.com, and, if you are in Ames, Pennsylvania, you must witness Joe play the djembe. And now, puny humans, on with the show.
Hey, Sparks fans, this is All You Ever Think About Is Sparks. This could be episode 33 or 34. I'm not sure. It depends on how quickly I can get this out. Full disclosure, this is a recording that we did do about a week ago. But for circumstances beyond my control, we lost that recording. But alas, but we're back. And about a week or so later, and some people have, we've all listened to the new album, The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte More, and some of us have been to some live shows on this tour. So that's a cool thing that I'd like to know a little bit more about. So let's get started with our introductions. I am your host, Christian Huey. I host this podcast. That's my contribution so far to Sparks. I have not seen a show on this tour yet, but it will happen on July 13th when my wife and I get back from our European holiday. But I want to pass it on to, I'm just going to go to the right of how I see these panels here. Mr. Monty Mallon, I think we've met before.
It's nice to see everybody. This is Monty. Good to see everyone. And that's about all I have to say.
Excellent. and I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to plug Monty's podcast, also So Important, which you get to interview some really fascinating people. And I couldn't recommend that enough.
Well, thank you.
Let's move over to Mr. Paul Barrett.
Hi. So, yeah, I'm Paul. My hobby is writing about Sparks, and recently that has that's changed into making videos about Sparks. I've got this YouTube channel called Meta Sparks, where I look at all the self-referential and meta ideas in their music, and that's my hobby. So, that's me. Hi.
Great. It's a great show. And I'm going to be leaning on you from time to time to give me some Meta Sparks insight into some of the questions I might have.
Sounds good.
Let's move on to before we do that. I'll get to that in just a moment. Let's move on to Miss Joe.
Oh, OK. I'm Joe Seeger. I have not seen them yet this tour, but I'm living vicariously through everybody else's posts. I have planned to see two shows end of the month. And my plan is to write more about Sparks. Right now, I just think about them a lot.
Joe, can you, for those who are not watching this, but just listening to this on a podcast, can you explain your attire?
Well, I got my little Sparks album cover earrings that I got from somebody in Etsy. You can just put the title of the album in. So I have Propaganda and Kimono in my house. I want to get more, like every album. I have a Russell, let's make it stand up, t-shirt from
area.
Yes, I have that, and then I have a little top hat that has skulls all over it because I like skulls, but I put a sticker of Ron and Russell from Plagiarism on their underwear and a picture of Ron that I just happened to have on a clip because I have pictures of Ron in various weird places. That's the way I am.
Excellent. My husband. Thank you so much. And last but certainly not least, Miss Penny Brown.
Hi, Penny. I'm a longtime Sparks fan. I first saw One Thursday Evening on Top of the Pops in 1974, the first performance of this town in Big Enough for the Both of Us, with my daughter, who was very small, who instantly fell in love with Russell. And since then, we've both loved and still love Sparks. Like Paul, I also have been writing about Sparks, usually just posting them on the fan sites, but somebody suggested I started putting them in a blog, which I've done recently, although I'm not sure I know exactly what I'm doing, but it's called Sparks Taught by Penny, if you want to look it up.
Absolutely. Does it have an easy web address to remember?
Not by me at the moment, no.
Okay. Well, I'll put a link when I post this up, certainly. Well, welcome, everybody. I'm really, really glad to have you guys back. Thank you so much for coming back. We're discussing the new album, still new, The Girl is Crying in Her Latte, which was released on May 26th, I want to say. So we've had some time to begin to absorb it. But I do want to give a couple of you guys who have seen a show where we're supporting the new album on their new tour to, you know, if there's anything you want to relay about your experience in the show, the shows that you saw in, where was it, Penny?
I saw Manchester, which is my hometown, which was completely nuts, as they usually are at Manchester. And in fact, Russell said that was one of their favorite places because it was always nuts. I don't know if he used that word, but that's right. And I saw the first astonishing performance at the Royal Albert Hall on Monday, last Monday.
Two shows. Oh, you saw the Albert Hall one?
Yes, yes.
That's fantastic. Now, let's see, Paul, you were at one of the same shows as Penny.
That's right. One of the highlights for me was meeting Penny by sheer coincidence. I was sat in the seat behind her.
Directly so behind, yes.
We'd just spoken for the first time the day before. And that was really nice. So yeah, we had a good Sparks chat beforehand and in the interval. But yeah, I was at the Manchester show and then the second night of Royal Albert Hall. And it was phenomenal. I mean, both gigs were incredible. The Royal Albert Hall show obviously had a real resonance to it. I mean, the size of the place, and just you could feel the love in the air. It was just a really exciting and emotional experience. And it feels like every single person in the room connected with Ron and Russell and the band, even, you know, right up in the gods. But for anybody going to see Sparks on this tour, you're in for such a treat.
It was their happiness at being there, their delight at being at the Royal Albert Hall was really very, very strong. And I think that when Russell introduced the musicians, then he handed the mic to Ron, and Ron just said, he gave a little speech at Manchester, but this time he just said, "Lead singer Russell," and thrust it back at him as though he was sort of almost, I wondered if he was too overcome with emotion to say much.
That's fantastic. How much of the set list were songs from the new album, approximately?
If it's not a spoiler, I've actually got a copy of the actual set list here that my fiance grabbed there.
Ah, wow, you framed it already.
Framed, yeah.
Wow.
Good choice, girl.
So, I can show you. I don't know whether we want spoilers for it, because, let's put it up.
It's all over the internet.
There it is. It's all there. You go.
I looked at it already.
For past spoilers.
Yeah.
Well, it just looks. Yeah, it looks like it's all over their discography.
That's the incredible thing. I mean, considering they play in the most prestigious venues of their career, I mean, a lesser band would just go for the surefire guaranteed hits. We'd go for the best of the Island years, plus a bit of Number One in Heaven, and you know, some little Beethoven. But no, they're playing a song like The Toughest Girl in Town.
Beaver O'Lindy,
Beaver O'Lindy, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, they did Beaver O'Lindy.
Oh, Beaver, yeah, that was phenomenal. So, yeah, these real deep cuts. I mean, people are so vocal about how much they hate Balls, and they went out and played that.
I can't get behind that.
Obviously, they're wrong.
I love Balls. So yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a fun thing to say. Well, fantastic. Yeah,
It was a really brave set list. We never, ever take the easy path, and that includes on this tour. And every song got...
On the album, too.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Take the easy path.
Exactly. The easy path would be to just follow up Steady Drip, Drip, Drip with a third album in the same vein. And this one is like, oh, this one is different.
Right. Yeah. And they talk about how they don't fit in and, you know, and not taking the easy route, basically, in a lot of the songs, right?
Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead.
One of the biggest hits was music that you can dance to. Everybody was up on their feet immediately with that. Yes.
Well, that just tells you the kinds of people who went to that show. I mean, these must be dyed-in-the-wool fans. Not, you know, your average Tom, Dick, and Harry and Jane is not going to know music that you can dance to.
That was kind of a magic moment for me as well, because everybody was seated at the gig up until music that you can dance to. Huh. And at the moment where people started getting on their feet was Russell ran to the lip of the stage. And you know the bit where it's, get up, dear, don't be shy.
Yes.
Every time. And when he would point, it was like it was like being in one of those mega churches or something. Because he'd go, get up, dear, and people would stand.
But it's so astounding because... Not only is that a fairly obscure song, that those albums weren't big hits in the UK.
Yeah. Or anywhere.
No. Yeah, but they played two songs from music that you can dance to.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy.
So I'm going to transition over to The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte. I finally took a whole bunch of notes because I've been listening to it nonstop. And this is something I've done before with another episode that Monty and I did. I just wrote down a few descriptors, a few adjectives about what I think the album may be about. And they're not always positive adjectives in the sense that they're not happy. Disappointment, rejection, groupthink, resignation, authority / defiance of authority, fleeing, escaping, and celebrity parentheses, the stresses of, comma, abuses of power of. Those are the things that came into my mind, and I've kind of attached some of those descriptors to the various songs on the 14-track album. Were there any just sort of overarching feelings or insights or opinions that you guys would like to share before we get into the individual songs on the album?
Well, there were quite a few political with a small p songs, and following on from Please Don't Fuck Up My World and so on. There are several songs on this album which are about the state of the world and about depression and, as Ron said about the first song, melancholy. Guess the world is to blame is the line in the song, and there are quite a few songs, notably the Mona Lisa and one or two other songs. Insecurities, obviously, I would add to your list. Favorite Sparks theme, of course, in Insecurities. And those are little moments. They're so good at capturing little observed moments or little moments of feeling, which might be fleeting, but you know, they managed to make a whole song out of it. I can say more about that when we get to it.
Yeah, really.
No,
Joe. Monty.
No. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh no, go ahead. I was agreeing with Penny.
I was just going to say that there's a fabric that ties this one together, and it's too early for me to fully be able to articulate what that is yet. But, you know, if you listen to the last one, which is a great album, It's a series in my mind, Paul, you may disagree, but it's a series of not necessarily associated songs. There are a couple themes that come up a couple times. There's some songs that are fun. There's some songs that are just very creative and out there. But then you have songs like iPhone and a couple of the others like that, which do have something to say. And this one seems to be more about those songs where they have something to say. Mm-hmm. And they're not looking for the easy accessibility to it. Somehow they do that and they still have these amazing hooks and the song stays with you forever. But yeah, it's not the easy access to these pop songs, even though they're still in a 3-minute format. That to me is pretty hard to pull off. Mm-hmm. And yet they do it so masterfully on this album. In my view, they do.
They like to challenge us, don't they? They've always liked to challenge us. And I think that's a lot of that is on this album. I mean, yeah, you look at the titles where things like A Love Story and When You Leave, any other singer you might expect to be a certain sort of breakup song or something like that. And then it's totally different. It's not at all what you expect. It disrupts our expectations. And I mean, the overall theme, so I should have mentioned about being defined and undefined and not well defined. I mean, that's something that seems to run through, I think.
Mm-hmm. But you know, they also like to challenge themselves.
Yeah. Which,
you know, it would be so easy. I'm sure not easy, but I mean, they could have just gone the easy route at the height of their popularity, but they didn't. They chose to do something more challenging. And I think that that's, to them, very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And when we get through the songs, there's one song in particular that does sound kind of like a defiance of expectations. We'll get there. Joe?
Now that I've listened to the album, it's funny you mentioned all the words you mentioned. I was kind of underlining when I was making my little notes. And I do have that melancholy, missed off connections, regret, defiance, almost, about some certain things, slight bitterness about past and, and how things are fleeting, stuff like that, and a lot of oppositions, like the title may be It's Sunny Today or Love Story.
That's right.
Dancing and the music is like opposite. It's like, but the words, the words actually go well with the music sometimes. So, yeah. So that's what I, there's a tightness. There's, like Simi said, depression with Mona Lisa, for example. We didn't know she was that way. Who would have known? But I suspected all along. But and a lot of discord, either with music or the chords, But I really like this album. Listen to the whole thing. Every single song. Oh, I like this one, Esther Humming. Oh, I like this one. Yeah. So I don't have any non-favorites. They're the favorite of the moment when I'm listening to it. And the different, I wake up with different songs in my head all the time. I'm humming them. So, yeah, I like it. I really do.
Thank you. Paul, Mr. Metasparks.
I'd like to build on what Joe and Penny said about the titles really subverting expectations, because I listened to an interview with Ron and Russell recently, and they were talking about using the title as a starting point for the song. So they were talking about You Were Meant For Me. And Ron said there are a million songs with that title. Yeah. But how do you take those words and make something new out of it? And I think that's a fascinating approach to songwriting. In general, I really agree that what we were saying about all of the, for want of a better word, like negative emotions on the album, it's so full of joy in so many places. Or if it's not joy, then melancholy. Can never say that word. But it's there are so many moments where you've got music that sounds happy with lyrics that sound sad, or vice versa, or somebody going from happy to sad. And it's this real clash of emotions that work in a great way. I see a lot of connections to Annette because at the start of this same interview, they were asked about the background of the album, and they said that they'd just finished writing Annette and they wanted to take something of that and put it into 3 or 4 minute pop songs. And I just put a video up today about my theories about Annette, how it's a lot of the subtext, I suppose, of that film is about screenwriting. Just like I've said on other albums, the subtext of certain albums, or well, most albums in my view, is about songwriting. So I think the form of screenwriting they were doing for Annette, they're taking some of that into this album. So you get very things it's got in common. The sad subject matter, which they don't tend to tackle that frequently. Sometimes there'll be a sad subtext, but it's very rarely about a sad topic. They're generally a really happy, positive band. There are little things like there are a lot of simple lyrics, like really simple lyrics. And I think that's done by intent in Not That Well Defined, I think it is. No, it's, I can't remember what song, but they say that you have to be defined. No, you have to be refined.
It doesn't have to be that way.
That's right, yeah. So I think they're intentionally writing these like quite dumb lyrics next to really deep and clever lyrics and putting the two together and saying, well, if you don't like it, then up yours. That's a British expression, I think. But yeah.
I read a review recently that said the one negative review I think that I've seen that's been posted anyway, where they talked about lazy lyrics in respect particularly of It's Sunny Today. And I mean, I would take issue with that because I think like Paul, you're looking at the, I think that looking at the language that the, when they do use simple language, it's done for a very specific purpose and to make a specific point. But anyway, when we get to It's Sunny Today, perhaps we can look at that.
That's a great point, Penny, because you know that escalator, they're very simple lyrics. And I guess somebody who doesn't see the big picture could say they're lazy lyrics. But on the other hand, they're using simple thoughts to convey a message in the context of the song and then in the context of the overall album. That's very powerful. So you don't need complex lyrics there for It's Sunny Today. And I think part of the reason it works so well is because it's not overdoing the message. It's just very direct. Paul, I have some meta theories about that. I don't know if we'll get into it, but I think there's a lot going on this album. I just want to add one last thought. And I know before we start talking about the songs, there's one other factor that I've seen beginning in Hippopotamus and then continuing on Steady Drip, 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 and then really coming to the front here, which is a factor that has not been that common in Sparks, which is reflectiveness. And talking about them and where they stand in their career and what lessons do they have for others and, you know, how do they see things at the advanced age that they are. And that, to me, is really interesting because that has not been a hallmark of Sparks. So, yeah, I hope we can return to that theme a little bit.
I agree that there is a lot, there is an unusual amount of reflection in this. And I just wanted to, echo a couple of things that both you and Paul mentioned. First off, the unhappy lyrics with more upbeat sounding song, that alchemy works on me so well, you know, for all of David Byrne does it and David Bowie does it and Ron does it so well when he does do it. And it creates this interesting thing because I relate to you all of these, you know, negative sounding adjectives that are the themes of a lot of the lyrics. And yet when they're juxtaposed with brighter, happier, major chord sounding songs and like uplifting beats and whatever, it does a really interesting thing where you take something that looks really sad on paper. And there's this, I don't know, patina of like acceptance or maybe some sort of an understated celebration, which I see in this album on some of these. But that was the one thing that I did come to me listening to this album. And that always strikes a chord with me. I also noticed, just speaking, you know, technically about the production of the album, there are sort of two modes that I hear, that my ear hears when I hear all the songs on here. You've either got the mode where you've got Ron and Russ and a computer, basically, where it sounds very intimate and it's synthesized and they're doing, you know, all the synthesizer work and the beats, and they're generating everything, versus the full band Sparks that tend to sound more anthemic. And the ones that do are really, really important songs that use the full band. In fact, I think many of those I wrote down as, you know, being key tracks in terms of like conveying what the album is all about. Well, we'll get to that. So may we start?
Is it due to the rain, or is she in some pain? She looks physically fine, guess it's something benign. The girl is crying in her latte, yeah. The girl is crying in her latte, sad. The girl is crying in her latte, wow. The girl is crying in her latte, bad. Now she's leaving the place, someone's taken a place. Orders then takes a seat, looks like it's a repeat. The girl is crying in her latte, yeah. The girl is crying in her latte, sad. The girl is crying in her latte, wow. The girl is crying in her latte, bad. So many people are crying in their latte. So many people are crying in their latte.
With the opening song, The Girl is Crying in Her Latte, the first single, first video, blah, blah, blah. That one's really been growing on me a bunch. I've got my own thoughts I'll share in a moment, but I'm going to pass it off to somebody else. Joe.
Okay. Yeah, that one, of course, the one we've heard the longest because it's the first single. And it kind of starts off static and electronic, right? And then it goes into this nice poppy beat, you know, and where where the girl is dancing, right? And they're sort of poking fun at people. To me, it's, you know, because not everybody can afford lattes. That's sort of a luxury drink, right? And they're all crying in their lattes, you know, but and they have time to sit around and cry in their latte when the whole world is kind of messed up. And, you know, mm-hmm. just so I think it's kind of like, making fun of people who are thinking they have it so bad, but oh, okay, I'll sit there with my latte at this cafe, you know, not have to worry about the other things in life. So that's kind of how that I took from that. And of course it starts out, you know, then it starts, the girl is crying in her latte, and then you start moving with it, you know, like, wake up, get over it, slap, slap, you know, instead of wallowing in it, you know, like, oh, you know, whatever, you know, my roses died in my garden, you know, or something, you know, because of the pollution, probably. But it's killing everybody. It's not just killing your roses. So, I mean, that's what, after listening to it and thinking about it, I still don't have the album yet, because my order came finally. One of my orders, I have two because I got mixed up and I ordered it again. But one through Island, the one through the Sparks Fan Club came, but it was the wrong records. It was not even it was two Suicide albums. I went, what?
Suicide, the band?
Yeah, Suicide. The Sparks? Same one. And I'm looking at the order, it clearly says Sparks, you know. I got album, CD, and cassette. And then I get this thing, oh, your Island pre-order is coming. Oh, I forgot, I ordered that.
These guys are like Shadow coming. Sparks.
Yeah, yeah.
They're probably like good. Evil Sparks.
Yeah, so I've been watching on YouTube to read the lyrics, because you need that. So with a little disadvantage. So I'm watching YouTube, singing along, reading the lyrics to, see if there's any more I can glean for these songs. But that one to me is, it's kind of funny, poking fun at people who think they have problems. We all have them. The whole world is a mess. So
a little bit of middle class ennui.
Yeah,
in there.
Exactly. My family.
Definitely, yeah.
I finally got around to reading the Pitchfork. Of course, if you ever want to read anything written by cooler than thou music fans, you go to Pitchfork. The reviewer made a reference to Eleanor Rigby when they get to the lyrics. So many people are crying in their latte. So many people are crying in their latte. Like, this is a portrait of, one girl who is sad, but in a world where everybody is sad.
Yeah.
For some reason. I also, sonically, a couple of things came into my mind. I don't know if you guys remember, a couple of years back, just like two, maybe 3 years back, there is a French DJ named Sebastian, and he released a single called Handcuffed to a Parking Meter. Where Ron, have you guys heard that?
So
when I heard that song, I'm like, I love this beat. I love the sound. This is great. I wish there were more sparks in this. And I feel like this is more of a sparksy version of that in a lot of ways, sonically, certainly, at least a lot of the same buzzing synths. In fact, a lot of the same synth patches that take me back to certain tracks on Exotic Creatures, which I thought was a cool sound. The world sucks. Every world sucks. Everyone is sad. Yes, that is definitely some melancholy there. And you said politics with a small P earlier, Penny. I hate to be this ugly American, but when I hear a line like "the girl is crying in her latte, sad," I cannot help. Did you get that too?
Yes.
I'm not the only one.
No.
Who thought of a certain former president?
Certain orange man.
A certain orange man, exactly.
With that hair. I know, we just sad.
I'd like to think that was intentional.
And, I think so. That too. I think they threw that in because that was like probably too tired of hearing that. But I thought that the first thing I heard it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this is why the world is so sad and bad.
Yeah.
Right? For one reason.
But in a way that is undefined, and this is where it struck me that this is the first sort of introduction of this theme, because the onlooker, the singer, says, is it the rain? Is she in pain? Is it this? Could be that.
We don't
know. Ultimately says, guess it's the world that's to blame. But the idea of this malaise or melancholy, Ron described it as sort of being not well defined here, is a theme that's obviously picked up several times later on.
Well, I agree with that. And what I like about it, which this is the kind of thing you get to appreciate after listening to it for a while and hearing the whole album. But what I like about it is that I hear how it really sets the tenor for the entire album, because it does have that upbeat poppy music, but then it has these kind of quirky lyrics. They're dealing with these uncertainties and this concern. What is she unhappy about? So it kind of sets the stage for what's to come, I think, very effectively.
Paul, do you have anything?
Yeah. I agree with you. There's definitely a hint of like first world problems to it.
Yeah.
And the state of the world as well with, everybody's stressed out basically, aren't they? But the way, I said these things tie into a net. Well, my theory about a net is they changed their style of songwriting. So they have covered sad subjects before, but it's always been like under a layer of like wit and irony. There's always something that sweetens the pill. Whereas with a net, they were writing real tragic music. They were writing about real pain, and there were no jokes to sort of make that easier for the listener. So in this interview, Ron and Russell said that they were taking something of that and putting it into 3 or 4 minute pop songs. So if you take this writing about tragedy and then put it into a 3 or 4 minute pop song, then that is kind of, how do you change that? How do you make that work? How do you evolve it? So my theory is they've evolved it from being like true sadness to being like about first world problems, basically. Mm-hmm. Right at the final scene of Annette, not to spoil anything, has a sad girl leaving. And partway through this song, the girl who's crying in her latte, she finishes a drink, she leaves. So we've got a sad girl leaving again. And it says, you know, someone else comes in. So I guess it's a repeat, or looks like it's a repeat. So they're repeating the sadness. I've got some theories on what you guys were saying about these albums being, or these last few albums being more reflective, but I'll leave that till later. Or, I do think it's more to do with the songwriting seeming more reflective because they're intentionally going to a darker place, because that's the constraints they're putting on themselves for these projects. There's probably a better way of explaining it, but I'll leave it at that for now.
Can I ask Paul a question about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. About the difficulty for me always about dating songs. You know, they say they wrote it after Annette, but I mean that they finished writing Annette, what, 10, 11 yeah. years ago? In the meantime, there were two other albums. So we wonder how the writing of this, you know, compared with the writing time-wise, you know, when they were written for Hippopotamus or for Steady Drip, Drip, Drip. Some of these songs sound as though they might have been written during the pandemic, because we know that Ron spoke about, you know, finding that quite difficult. But we don't know exactly when any of these songs were written. So,
well, there's the podcast I was listening to. It's called Tim's Listening Party. So it's Tim Burgess. I was surprised when they said they started writing it immediately after Annette, because obviously that clashes with other work. But the songs for Annette, their inception was 9 years before Annette's release. But said was that the whole process was an evolutionary one. So they would add songs, they would take them away. And the second part of the video I'm putting out about Annette is talking about how the symbolism in the film reflects how these songs change, right? So the songs change as the characters change. It's a lot to go into here. So what they tend to do on a lot of songs in a way that's far from obvious, a lot of albums rather, is they pass the baton between albums. So as an example, I know I'm going well off the subject of The Girl Who's Crying in a Latte here. Take the song, As I Sit Down to Play the Organ at the Notre Dame Cathedral. The next song chronologically is
Good Morning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And look at what the songs have got in common. They've both got foreign women, which comes up quite a lot. Foreign love interests. They've both got performance, because in Good Morning, I can't remember the line in Good Morning. They've both got references to drinking beer. There are like 5 or 6 things that they've got in common, like strong themes. So it's got a French reference, so they tend to like hand over between albums in ways that are really counterintuitive, and you have to really sort of dig into it to see it clearly. But
did they say then anything about how the Hippopotamus and Drip, Drip, Drip fit into that space between Annette and Latte then?
Did they say
anything about that?
No. This is something that would take a lot of justification, but Hippopotamus Every song on it can be tied into the writing process of Annette, which
I can't wait to hear this.
Steady drip, drip, drip. Every song tied to the opening scene of Annette.
Okay. Well, I
haven't been up, but
I'll just jump in though. I guess the where I would see it, Penny, is that once it became something that was actually done and produced, and there was actually a soundtrack released, so maybe it was just more prevalent in how they were thinking. Because I can see the connections in terms of the tenor of it. Mm-hmm. You know, the rest are obviously great things to think about that Paul always raises, but I can see how that tenor could have a parallel to what you hear here in some way. But I know I'm sorry if I'm holding things up.
You guys are way too insightful for so many songs. That's all right. We have 13 more to go. But thank you so much, Paul, especially there. Song number two is Veronica Lake. This is another one where you've just got R&R there at the computer and the keyboard.
There's a war going on, can't make a mistake, all the girls are on the line, they must stay awake every beat 29, so much at stake, but they're working on the line, till they all relate, and they all do want to be Veronica Lake, with that peek-a-boo-y hair, it's a big mistake, as the foreman has to yell, put on the brake, yet another girl caught Veronica Lake. Just the one they all adore, Veronica Lake. And that peek-a-boo-y hair, it's a big mistake once again for many years. Put on the brake is the wrong way the air. Millions partake and they fancy themselves, Veronica Lake.
Monty?
Well, I'll throw out a thought. I think it's really literally the only song on this whole album which stands alone as just a story that they wanted to tell, as opposed to something that has, a kind of a deeper meaning to it. And obviously it has a meaning, but to me, it just stands out that way. It's kind of an anomaly on the album, just like the next one is. So when we talk about that one, then I have a couple points that I want to make. But I like the song. But it just kind of stands out on its own a little bit to me. I don't quite see it fitting in quite thematically the way the others do.
I think I hammered it into a shape where it might fit in thematically, but we'll see about that. First of all, I didn't know the story. I didn't know that Veronica Lake cut her hair during World War II because so many women who were working in the factories to support the war effort had grown their hair like Veronica Lake, you know, all over one eye and draping down and everything. And there were accidents that happened. So Veronica Lake, at the behest of the U.S. government, made a hair safety video. And she showed up in that with her own newly shorter haircut, which then so many of these women then copied, and then there were fewer accidents. So that's a great story. And you know, if I wanted to find a way to hammer it into a shape of one of the things that I talked about that I thought maybe this album was about, celebrity comes up a few times in this. So I thought about the power of celebrity to influence people, whether that is for good or for ill, to destroy themselves or to perhaps save themselves or improve themselves. But the idea of the power of celebrity having power that you may not fully appreciate or understand, and how destructive it may be.
There's one other really interesting aspect, though, is the idea of choices, which is something that comes through. Choice and consequence is something that comes through throughout this album. And that's exactly what this song gets to, choice and consequence.
Very good.
So it does have, it does fit into the fabric.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, I always think of that song, Electronica Veronica, you know, with a little house dub beat and the techno. But, you know, it's just a history lesson, right? Kid, boys and girls, let's talk about Veronica Lake. And the thing, I guess I could, you know, with the whole war effort and having people copy her and then made her cut her hair so everybody would follow her. You know, again, it's somebody who's very, that they made her cut her hair, which was really her, right? And so now the defining thing of her appeal and her look is gone because maybe they don't like individualism. You got to follow. And again, that's kind of the, how the album goes. You can't be outside the line. You can't, you know, this. And so, you know, when somebody gets too powerful, like Elvis, you know, for example, they wanted him to change everything and try to stop him because he was too powerful. And powers that be don't like that. Now, in this case, there was some practical, you know, application, you know, people getting their hair caught in the machines, you know. But you can tie it back. You know, we don't have to get rid of it. But I just thought, yeah, they take what was her individual thing and they made her change it so that she wasn't Veronica Lake anymore. You know, so that kind of comes up later. I mean, it took me a while to come up with that, but I started thinking about her. And yeah, again, they wanted me, you want you to change and conform. And that's part of you're talking about.
She's a victim of fame as well. I mean, she's a casualty of war, as the song says, but she's a victim of fame in that the fickle public desert her when she no longer has the look that they want, the iconic look that they want. I mean, it's like Mona Lisa is, you know, suffers in a way from as a victim of fame. But there's also the idea of the women, it's been satire about women, you know, sort of like in the song That's Not Nastasia, where, you know, the women fans want to copy their their heroes, dress like them, have their hair like them.
Paul?
So my theory connects it back to Annette again, because the theme of the song is harming your career for the greater good, for the war effort. Now, Veronica Lake, the first film that she was in where her career was affected, where she was given third billing rather than being a Veronica Lake movie. It was called Out of This World. And the plot is very similar to the plot of Annette. It involves somebody who is, he's a performer who chooses not to sing at a huge performance, at a huge concert watched by millions at the end of the movie, which, apologies if I just spoiled Annette for anybody, but it's a really similar concept. And of course, when baby Annette is born in the movie, the song they sing is She's Out of This World. So the concept of harming your, or sacrificing your own career for the good of the war effort, I can see that in meta terms, because I put out that video about Terminal Jive, where my claim on that is that it's something they didn't really want to be a hit record. I've said the same thing about Annette and the same thing about Bulls. We know that they don't chase hits. We know that they're happy playing. They'll put something out. If people like it, great. If they don't, never mind. So the idea of sacrificing an opportunity, like having a big movie starring A-list talent, is that's a really powerful thing to get, you know, one of the world's most acclaimed directors to get this big budget and, you know, Adam Driver to star in your film and then use it for an art film that hardly anybody's seen. If that's done by intent, you know, they could have done a film with Edgar Wright that would have, you know, that could have been a smash hit. It could have been a popular, it could have taken all the happy, joyful side of Sparks. Mm. But instead they said, no, we're going to do this difficult art movie. That is sacrificing their career for the greater good. So that's how I see this song. I don't know if that makes sense to anybody else, but I find that quite satisfying.
I love it. We're going to move on, pushing for time here. Song three, Nothing Is As Good As They Say It Is. This was, of course, released before the album.
Nothing is as good as they say it is. That's the way it is. I wish I'd known beforehand. I was born just 22 hours ago, but I want to go back to my former quarters. Mama, mama, can you accommodate? Mama, mama, tell me I'm not too late. Mama, mama, can you cooperate? This will not work, I'm sure. Nothing is as good as they say it is, and I'd be remiss if I weren't honest with you. This is not a place that I can exist, not a gratefulness. I just don't want this, want this. Mama, mama, is there a remedy? Can I just go back where I used to be? I was happy where I was previously, just doting there, stood tall. Mama, mama, please sympathize. This has been such a bad surprise. I won't ask any more from you.
This is the first song of the album where you really hear the full band sound, and it does sort of, to my ears, harken back to, I guess we'll say, the island years, Kimono era. It sounds a lot like the self-effacing from Steady Drip Drip just a few years ago, just on a superficial basis. I mean, we get the story. It's pretty straightforward. Ron's lyrics here are kind of classic Ron in that they are straightforward, in that you get what he's saying, and he's taking on a character and a point of view, and it's funny. And so, of course, you know, it's a baby who's just been born. I think it was Paul who said this could be the character from it was on Hippopotamus. What was it?
Unaware.
Thank you. Unaware. This could be the same fetus now born and deciding, you know, yeah, this time I'm not for it. Please go.
No, I say it ties up more closely with tryouts for the human race, I think, because there, you know, there's one of the swim that wants to be your daughter or your son, and now this one has achieved that and doesn't like it. It hasn't lived up to expectations.
Look, take me back.
I like that. That's funny. Yeah. What if what comes from the tryouts for the human race is someone who doesn't want you as a parent and doesn't want to be there? I like that. Joe, were you saying something?
No, I agree with you on that. I could see it on Kimono Propaganda. The same witty lyrics, you know, about, you know, he can deal with a lousy view, you know, just put me back. Although, you know, and I think it's because he's born in the U.S., because he'd been, well, if it was born in the south of France, you know, again, they're leaning towards their France.
I want to get into that in just a moment.
Yeah.
Finish whatever it is you were going
to
say.
That's kind of what I was stood out to me. I mean, the words are just so witty and funny. You can't help but laugh, and you don't blame him. You know, that he wants to go out back in. You know, he really knows this is not for me. Thank you, Mom, but no thanks. Thanks, but
they've
no
been singing in these. They've been singing in the south of France tonight, so we'll see how that's going down.
Yeah, yeah.
So that line. That stanza right there. Okay. Thank you both for this special chance. Were I born in the south of France, I would feel less resistant to somewhere that just deserves adieu. That to me says that this baby isn't necessarily unhappy with being in the world, but where geographically he or she was born. And I can't help but think about the United States of these America, since that, of course, is where Ron and Russ hail from. So I picked up a little political discourse in there. I don't know if anyone else did.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Anyone have anything? Oh, I just want to also, I've been trying to highlight like lines that, you know, that really stand out to me. And I'd be remiss if I weren't honest with you. This is not a place that I can exist. Yeah. Says so much to me about so much about this album. Anyone else have anything they would like to add about? Nothing.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, just to build on the Unaware comparison. So Unaware is about some parents who are protecting a baby from, well, not necessarily the horrors of the world, but the mundanity of the world, because it talks about, you know, Taylor Swift has something new, Nike has a brand new shoe. You know, it's all these kind of clickbait headlines that they want to this baby to be unaware of. And here the baby emerges and is maybe, you know, sees this pair of Nike shoes and thinks, or sees these clickbait headlines and thinks, I want out. So it feels like a direct sequel to me. And I can tie both songs to Annette from either side, but
we should make a whole episode about that.
Exactly. Yeah.
We'll
exactly.
Do a whole episode about connections.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to use up everybody's time, but you know, very briefly, born 22 hours ago, 22 months before was when Annette was released. It would be okay if I was in South France.
Wow.
It sounds like a small connection. on the surface, but these things are scattered throughout the album. If my theory is right about taking this sadness that they developed with Leos Carax from that project into this project, then they're saying, I've had enough of that. It might have been okay if I was born in the south of France, like the Cannes Festival, for instance. Mm-hmm. So that's my tenuous link. So
okay, I can't wait until we can delve much deeper into the Annette connections, because Annette is still a nut that I don't think I've really mentally cracked. We'll get there.
Can I just to give a couple thoughts? Two thoughts. One, I find it very interesting that the three songs that start this album are the three songs that start this album, meaning that. I kind of feel like, you know, those were also the songs that were released as singles. Those were the songs they wanted people to hear, and they're accessible. Certainly this one is very accessible, and it reminds, I kind of see it as like a B-side from the Island Years, but definitely, you know, those were great B-sides. So, I hear that, and I think it's
barbecue,
you know, it's just a fun way to, they started the album with the ones that are a little bit more accessible, and then with the next song, they kind of start the album for real in a way. These three kind of set up the album and then they get into it. But I'm going to hit you with something here, which I've been thinking about. There's really four themes going on this album. And that's why I think this album is so masterful. And this is totally Monty Mallon being Paul Barrett meta extreme. Okay. But, you know, one is just great songs, but you can listen to it and you say, hey, that's a really good album. The two of the things that we're talking about, which is the underlying messages of the anxiety and the duality between the happy beats and the really kind of somber words. And how does that play out? What does that mean? But then I think there's two other ones. And one is there are a number of songs that hit on their career, which gets into that reflective part. And we can talk about that as we go through it. But then here's the other one I want to make, which I think this kicks off. There's a life cycle album. There's a life cycle being described, which is a theme they've done before. In number
waiting
one, in
for
heaven,
someone to say that,
and a couple of other places too, they've done that life cycle thing. And I will even tell you the songs that I think fit into it, which are "Nothing Is as Good as It Say It Is," "Escalator," "You Were Meant for Me," "Take Me for a Ride," "It's Sunny Today," and then "Gee, That Was Fun." Now, some of those are parallel, like, you know, they also might impact the career, but maybe if at the end we have time for me to lay this out a little more, because I know we want to keep moving. But I think that this guy who's born in "Nothing Is as Good as Say It Is" then goes and has this life that's described in these songs. And at the end, we'll come back to it.
Yeah.
But it's very powerful if you listen to it that way. And "It's Sunny Today" is coming to the end of his spouse, and "Gee, That Was Fun" is his final words as he thinks about all this. I mean, it's very powerful. I could be wrong. Over to you, Christian.
Thanks, guys. We're going to move on to track four, Escalator. My, this one's really been an earworm for me.
Escalator.
I know that when we talked about a week or so ago, and I heard it with virgin ears, it sounded like a lawnmower. It still does. It's a lawnmower that sounds to me just sonically and everything. This is a song, of course, about misconnections. It reminded me a bit thematically of Johnny Delusional. To me, kind of reads, you know, pretty straightforward. Ron has written songs like that. This one is really mellow. I love the production. I really do. This is where I love having just Ron and Russ and, you know, a couple of toys, you know, communicating something that's very personal. And I think that's what it is. This production, this kind of production sounds very personal to me. And this is a very personal story about misconnections. But I'm going to leave it at that. And I'm going to pass it on to whoever else might have some insights. Oh, I'm going to pick on Penny.
Well, first of all, the shows that I saw, Escalator replaced Veronica Lake on both of them. I don't know whether that was the case in all the shows, but it went down extremely well. There was a lot of stomping, certainly in Manchester, there was a lot of stomping and you know, sort of clapping along, but this is another song that was accused by the aforementioned critic of lazy lyrics. And I think the way I see this is that because he's capturing he's capturing a moment of how it felt at the time. This isn't a song of kind of Proustian reflection about, I saw this girl on the escalator and it would have been nice to ask her to dance, but, you know, what he's trying to do is using the simple words to capture how it felt
in that moment.
Yeah, that's why I think this is quite powerful and why it's simple. But in performance, it was helped by this extraordinary lighting rig that they had at the back, which was the lights are moving up and down, sort of like an escalator. So that was quite
Exciting. It upsets me, you know, to hear that someone was calling some of these lyrics lazy when it just sort of like, you know, did anyone say that, you know, to John Steinbeck? You know, when he's just, you know, or I guess Hemingway even.
Hemingway, yeah.
Yeah, just describing what is happening with No Frills. And then you fill in the emotional blanks, you know, yourself. Anyway, I love that song. Paul, Joe?
Again, it's, I get the feeling of the fleeting, you know, the fleeting moments in our life that you miss a lot because it's just, hey, okay, that's gone, you know. And so, you know, they capture that very well. And you know, it's, I don't have a whole lot more to say because you said it all, Christian. So, yeah, but it's just, going up while she's going down. I went to work, she's coming from work. You know, it's like we're always going opposite directions. But now and then you have that moment. And you just got to grab it. But then he said, but there's not a chance to ask her to dance, you know. So you know, it's kind of sad too, but I don't know. I like the sad song, I guess.
Me too.
I completely agree with that. I think it's with Spark songs, a lot of the time it's about a particular moment in the song that really elevates it from being a normal song to being something like magical. And the lyrics feel like that. You know, you have just this one fleeting glance while they pass each other on the escalators, and having that reflected in the music when the full sound comes in live. That sounded phenomenal.
It did,
lucky enough to see, Escalator and Veronica Lake at the Royal Albert Hall gig, and Escalator was far and away the best. So, so you did okay there. Yeah, it was. It's a beautiful song. I love the Mellotron sounds on it.
Mellotron, you're right.
The happy, sad vibe is that's throughout the album. I think it's really good. Great song.
Totally. Did I forget anyone?
I'll just add that this was one of the songs that when I first heard the album a couple times, I didn't care for it at all, and now I listen to it and it's like, oh. This is a good song.
Yeah. That's
why interesting. Sparks people should not be judging this album from the first listen or two.
No.
It's right.
I just don't think that works.
No, this happens all the time, doesn't it? Things, yeah. The songs you didn't like become.
Well, what I like, one of the things that I like about this song is that it doesn't have a driving beat like many of the others. It sounds suspended. You know, just as the, you know, narrator is suspended in this thought and in this moment, it has this sort of, I don't know, just hermetically sealed and floating quality that is very different from what has just come before it in the album. And it's arresting to me and my attention. So having said that, let's move on to song 5, The Mona Lisa's Packing, Leaving Late Tonight.
She might seem dispassionate, but that's not true. She feels much the same as everyone, me and you. But the current atmosphere is blue, too much for her. And she's making the decision, do what's right for her. No one knew she was so disturbed. No one knew she seemed imperturbed. No one knew she was so uptight. The Mona Lisa's back and even late tonight. All the world is agitated, ill at ease. But she always felt she'd rise above all maladies. But it's now become impossible for her to smile. So she's going to take a credit card and rack up miles. No one knew she was so disturbed. No one knew she seemed imperturbed. No one knew she was so uptight. The Mona Lisa's back and leaving it to.
I didn't really take a whole lot of notes here, and I'm afraid that it would have been redundant anyway. But does anyone have anything they want to say about track 5, the Mona Lisa's Packing, Leaving Late Tonight?
It's fun. It's a great, fun song, in my opinion.
Great beat.
Yeah.
Shuffle.
Yeah, the shuffle. I like that. It's good music to pack up by. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pack big up. Time earworm.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And you know, I just, you know, again, there, it's kind of a funny thing because, you know, Mona Lisa, you know, she has a half smile. And, you know, like I said, some people probably wonder, is she ready to crack up laughing or is she smiling to keep from being like full of fear, right? Or insecure. And I guess it was the latter because she took off. She says, I had it with all the people looking at me all the time, you know, and I could just see that her little, I mean, I see the cartoon kind of thing where she steps out of the picture with her bags, gets out of there, and people will come, and there'll be an empty picture in the museum where she took off. That's what I see. I think I have cartoon.
I agree with that.
She's a great cultural icon who gives up on the world that created her. All the world is ill at ease, is agitated, ill at ease, it says. I mean, so it ties up with the first song in a way, and it's with the girl crying in a latte. The most famous smile is also crying.
Yeah.
Did you have more?
Inside.
Did you have more, Penny?
No, except the little reference at the end to the fact that reminding us that she's a painting about the hoping the sun doesn't fade her priceless imagery. That's a little joke at the end.
It's such a funny joke, though, isn't it? That like no one knew she was so disturbed.
Yes.
When the famous thing about her is that she's got this unreadable smile.
Yes. I think right. Undefined, you might say.
It ties up with that ill-defined theme again.
I'm reading it.
Well, and then on the lyric front, that next line, no one knew she seemed imperturbed. We talked about this the last time. Another writer might have said she was never perturbed or something like that. And he chooses this great little turn of phrase there. She seemed imperturbed. Wonderful.
And no one knew it.
The other thing I wouldn't mind saying about it is Mona Lisa is art from France in the Louvre. Like Sparks went to France with Annette. And then they moved to Island Records. And here you got the Mona Lisa leaving to go to an island nation in the sun. And I think it's, again, it spells out that journey from Annette to this album.
Oof. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good one. So inscrutable, Mona Lisa. And the song to me so far, anyway. But I enjoyed it. Great beat. 6, You Were Meant For Me.
I can plainly see that you were meant for me, that you were meant for me tonight. Don't see the point, not getting to the point that you were meant for me tonight. Who comes after me? I'd better be a perfect specimen of man.
This is a really affecting song about seemingly the beginning of a love story, and you know the guy here just doesn't have the time or want to deal with the time of all of the yada 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 and until their relationship is real and true and deep and whatever. Turn the pages over and over and over again. That's really, really affecting to me. How does it all end? Can we just skip all the bullshit? Can we just get to the ending, skip to the good part? Go, please, Penny.
No, is it the good part? I thought that how will this all end? That he's sort of looking to the end of a romance already, either good or bad. Perhaps experience sort of limits the expectations and it doesn't know what's going to happen.
No, you're right about that. I missed that reading completely. How does it all end? As in, how does this relationship end? Right. That's a lot more melancholy.
Ill-defined.
Yeah, ill-defined. Yeah. Ill-defined. I really do like the line, I don't see the point not getting to the point. Which conveys a lot of, I don't know, where I think maybe Ron and Russ maybe at this point in their lives, just as people, just like, you know, I don't have time for bullshit. Can we please just get to what this is all about? So Joe, did you have some thoughts?
Yeah, it's for some reason I was thinking of that song Popularity. I don't know why. The music wise, and he's talking about that their fates, they met here, and then you were meant for me. Sometimes I think the person didn't always think that, but they their shopping carts hit, which reminded me of Here Comes Bob, when he used to run into women's cars to meet them. So that's kind of like, oh, you know what? I'm just going to run into your car and get this over with. No, you know, messing around, get around to chit chat, and let's turn the pages and see how does this all end? Because I don't want to waste my time, you know, kind of thing. So it's just a funny take on those old things. You know, I didn't get that at first. After listening to it, those songs popped in my head. So yeah, that's how my brain works.
That's a deep cut. I appreciate that.
Rare.
Well, the only thing I'll add is if you just listen to it as a love song and not get overly carried away with the analysis, it's kind of a fun song.
It is. I love it.
It's just a fun song. And it's just really it's a catchy little song. And I love the way the music plays out. It's just a nice little break in a way from all the maudlin-ness on this album. But the second point I'd make is if you think about what I was saying before, and I know we'll talk about this later, if we have time, we do find out how it ends. If this is a life cycle, if there's a life cycle being played on this album, I think we do find out how it ends. And that's cool to me. Kind of a neat thought.
Paul?
Jim. So, my favorite line is at the Monoprix, you stood out to me.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've been writing about is how every single Sparks album has a foreign love interest. It's kind of inevitable that it'll end up on and references to France on all these albums. So the Monoprix is a French supermarket, so the girl that's meant for him is French, so another foreign woman. So I really like that they've got this running joke that you can only spot if you've listened to enough Sparks, like in Johnny Delusional. He says, I know yes and no in a couple dozen other languages. Mm-hmm. And it's so subtle, but it's really, really funny joke. I really like that the line is, you were meant for me tonight. So you were meant for me sounds like it's eternal, but you know, it sounds like you spend the rest of your life with her. But tonight is a very temporary thing. That reminds me of You're So Important Right Now. It's the same joke.
Yeah.
So to spare everybody's time, I won't go into the theories about it being go into that style, that sad style of songwriting and moving on. But yeah, there are plenty of links to Annette in this one as well.
Don't scamper too far off, you bipedal carbon blobs. All You Ever Think About Is Sparks will return soon for part 2 of our chat on The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte. End communication.